From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Ron Powers, media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Powers is also a native of Mark Twain's hometown, Hannibal, Missouri. Powers returned to Hannibal as an adult, and he's written a book describing how Hannibal's tried to cash in on Twain's fame. Also today, I talk with James Lachlan. In 1936, Lachlan founded New Directions Books, which published unconventional writers no one else would touch, like Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the gospel roots of soul singer Sam Cooke, and book critic John Leonard reviews Perfect Gallows, Peter Dickinson's mystery set in Africa. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest Ron Powers is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Radio and Television Criticism in 1973 when he wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times. In 1984, Powers followed his urge to visit the small town he grew up in, Hannibal, Missouri. Nationally, that town is best known as the home of Mark Twain. When Powers returned to Hannibal, he found the town caught up in the planning stages of the Mark Twain Sesquicentennial, a celebration of Mark Twain's 150th birthday. With the help of consultants and big bucks, Hannibal would be transformed into a theme park version of itself. The goal was to lure visitors from around the country and revive the town with tourist dollars. Powers was fascinated by this new gaudy caricature of Hannibal and how it compared with the real small town that he remembered. This comparison is the subject of his book White Town Drowsing, Journeys to Hannibal, which has just been published in paperback by Penguin Books. I spoke with Ron Powers earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York, and I asked him why he initially wanted to go back to Hannibal.
Oh, I never stopped wanting to go back ever since I left, which was a long time ago. Back in 1959, I was 17. My father was a Fuller Brush man, and he'd worked those neighborhoods of Hannibal, I guess, for longer than I'd been alive. And he finally decided that there were better times and greater opportunities somewhere else. So he packed us up and moved us away. It was probably not the greatest town to be a grown-up in, if you're trying to make a living and be accountable to all the other people in the town. But for a boy, or a girl, I'm sure, it was enchanted. It was just a wonderful little enclave of hills and rivers and good friends and a very ordered, lyric way of life. So I never... It was almost as though my boyhood was sealed off and bottled that summer of 1959. When you're 17, you're just about finished being a child. But that allowed me to remember Hannibal through a child's eyes and not through the harsher and more realistic prism of adulthood. And that's the way I kept the town preserved through all those 25 years between the time I left and the time I started going back.
You know, I think there's two themes that always haunt us from our childhood, either the one of wanting to return to where we're from or wanting to get away from it, depending
yes.
on what our life circumstances have been.
Exactly. And I guess I missed out on the first part of that. You could probably still find my heel marks in the dirt on the way to Jefferson City if you looked, because I didn't want to leave. It later became obvious to me that it made sense to leave. There was just not very much going on. The 20th century had long since bypassed Hannibal, and I guess I did want to sort of become part of it. And really became a part of the media world that in a strange way came back to invade Hannibal just a couple of years ago, the summer that I started to return.
Yeah, your return to Hannibal coincided with the planning of the Sesquicentennial celebration.
Everybody just called it the Sesqui, Terry.
The Sesqui, okay, thank you. Well, it was really a sign of the times that in planning this, the whole idea was to exploit history to get the tourist trade.
Exactly. And it was, there were no bad guys in all of this. It wasn't as if there was a corrupt mayor or city council or chamber of commerce, or even the consultants and the marketing experts who came streaming into Hannibal that summer didn't have bad designs in mind. They wanted to prop up a town that, like a lot of river towns, had lost its economy. The railroads were gone. The logs that had floated down the Mississippi to be sawed into lumber had stopped flowing down. Shoe company had left. all that was left, really, for Hannibal was the legacy of that great man and the wish to, in many ways, an authentic wish to celebrate that legacy, but at the same time to make a little money.
Well, the concept was almost to turn all of Hannibal into a Mark Twain theme park.
To make the town a parody of itself. And that, I think, was the... that was sort of the original sin. That's what turned around to sort of corrode and cheapen, really, that summer. Turned the town against itself. It became a kind of a tragicomic battle for the soul of a little town. And it was funny because... The two halves of my life were sort of at war as I went back and reported this story. The child in me who remembered a town that had an integrity, that had a center, that had patterns that made sense and that I flourished in when I was a kid. Now that town was at sort of doing battle with the things that I had come to understand as a grown-up and as a media critic, the forces of market research, the people who come in and hand out questionnaires and say, we know what the consumers want and here's how you can sort of gear it up to gratify them. Logos, sort of brand names, all-purpose amusements. You know, people dressed up like Mark Twain, for instance. People dressed up like jumping frogs in styrofoam frog suits, steamboat races, parades, and that kind of thing. Somewhere the real Mark Twain was getting lost, and the real connection of Hannibal with its mythic history was getting lost. And I was there to sort of watch it happen.
What's great, although the real Mark Twain was getting lost, every Mark Twain impersonator between the Atlantic and the Pacific showed up in Hannibal.
That's true. It was worse than Elvis Presley's imitators. There were guys who wore black Mark Twain suits and didn't smoke cigars because their research had told them that was how he did it. And there were the guys who wore the white Mark Twain suits and did smoke cigars. And they were all sort of baring their teeth at one another, like two guests at a cocktail party who were working on the same dissertation, I guess. And somewhere along the line, I think the humor and the joy of it got lost.
Over $26,000 was spent on a Sesqui video. And I guess the purpose was to advertise all the frivolity on television. But one of the narrative parts, which you quote in your book, is the narrator says, there is really no place in the world like Hannibal, Missouri. Every day is like a chapter in a magical dream. Gosh, I love that copy.
Enough to turn your cheeks green and make your eyes bug out. And really, that's that very kind of hyperbole, that sort of advertising-driven view of Hannibal, has had a damaging effect in the town. School children grow up not consuming Mark Twain as a wonderful storyteller or as a rich source of fantasy. He's a brand name that looks out at them from the back of produce trucks and cheap motels. They don't even teach, or didn't when I left. They weren't teaching Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn in the public school system. Not for political reasons, but because the kids were tired of the image.
Well, in Hannibal's attempt to create this great media image for itself and to turn history into a theme park, here's what I figure happened to you. This story was your big chance to write about something that wasn't media. You know, you return home to your hometown, and you get to a town that's trying to become the TV version of itself.
Bingo. Exactly right, Terry. You asked earlier, a few minutes ago, why I started going back, and I'm not even sure I gave you the real answer. I had a son. He arrived on my 40th birthday, which is now a day away from being 6 years ago. And as soon as he came along, this flood of memories was released in me. I had a strong urge to leave a record for Dean, and now for Kevin, about darkness as opposed to a kind of urban fluorescence, about the way the seasons change, what a rundown ballpark looked and smelled like. And I wanted to let them know where I came from. My father hadn't let me know much about where he came from. So I went back there to do nothing more than to look for memories, and found that the kind of forces that I was writing about as an adult had more or less sort of preceded me to this sacred ground, and that made it such a compelling story in and of itself that I really couldn't turn loose of it.
Ron Powers is my guest, and he's media critic for CBS Sunday Morning, and we're discussing the subject of a book that he wrote called White Town Drowsing, which is about his return to his hometown of Hannibal, Missouri. You know, I live in Philadelphia, and we're no slouches here ourselves in terms of, you know, using history to attract the tourism trade.
Yeah, something happened in Philadelphia once, didn't it?
Yes. And there's many people dressed as Ben Franklin
right.
in this city. But I wonder, what kind of vacationer do you think really wants to go to a place to see people dressed in costumes of the past?
That question is so interesting, and it was really answered by a very smart woman of Hannibal, a woman who'd sort of become my guide through the various political machinations that were going on. She looked around her halfway through this summer of this kind of failed and glitzy celebration, and she said, you know, people come to Hannibal just to touch the way we live. And she was right. I mean, people drive into that town, I think, in search of an American past. And something of the village that Mark Twain wrote about when he talked about the white town drowsing in the sunshine of a summer's morning is still there. The buildings that were up when he was writing those books are up still along the riverfront. And if you have a little patience and can take a little time, you can find the ancient charm of an American village. So that, I think, is what was getting lost.
You met with the consultant who put this package together.
Mm-hmm.
Did he strike you as a cynical kind of guy? Do you think the consultants who package this kind of stuff are, on the whole, pretty cynical about tourists and vacationers?
I think that cynicism is a real hazard of the consulting mentality. That is not to say that people who go by the numbers and who believe in behaviorist research are necessarily cynical. But what they give up, and I think what this guy encouraged Hannibal to give up, was the spontaneous voice, the sense of intuition, the sense that the kind of faith in metaphor and an imagery that really propelled Mark Twain to write his books. Mark Twain didn't do any market research before he brought Huckleberry Finn into the world. And I think that these people are, I think that really the whole country, if you think about politics, television news, even education, the kinds of textbooks that are selected and printed, we have abandoned our sense of what is right from the intuitive voice almost wholesale to the consulting mentality, and it's produced a kind of an artificial overlay over the whole popular culture.
Well, an easy example of this is that the consultant who organized all this is from New York.
Yes.
What does he know about Hannibal?
Used to be Patton's
small
public
town
relations. Used to be Patton's public relations man.
Oh, gosh.
Truly. Yeah.
How did the final celebration and the amount of people who turned out for it compare to what the dream was supposed to be?
Sort of like the last pages of Araby, that wonderful James Joyce story of the boy who finally makes it to the bazaar when it's closing down and the lights are going off. It really would have been a decent enough celebration if that had been all they promised the people of Hannibal. I mean, they had some parades and they had a rock concert and they had some really nice historical moments. But the memory of these sort of Byzantine dreams that had been spun out, this sort of glittering pleasure dome on the Mississippi that would thrust Hannibal back into the 20th century in an almost Disney World kind of way, were still lingering. And that tarnished and provided a kind of bittersweet counterpoint to what really happened. I guess the crowning blow was that on November 30th, 1985, which would have been Mark Twain's 150th birthday, Hal Holbrook, who has made a terrific career doing his Mark Twain impressions, was to have been there for the gala closed-down celebration. He finally sort of, I think he must have gotten wind of all the things that were going wrong, wrote a letter and said, sorry, other commitments, I can't make it. So that was really the final blow. Except for the book, which, by the way, I was happy that the people of Hannibal felt warmly toward the book. A lot of newspapers and magazines had blown through town and done some articles that were satirical, and I think the people felt a little exposed and a little humiliated. But I think they sense the goodwill in the book itself, and I was very happy for that.
Well, you're reverent about the town. It's just the celebration that you,
exactly.
you thought was strange. You know, when your book came out, reviewers and publicity drew comparisons to Garrison Keillor because this is about a small town. And with all due respect to Garrison Keillor, who's absolutely wonderful, did that drive you crazy?
You know, there wasn't that much. It did come up in a few articles. I don't think the Times or the New Yorker or some of the other papers really drew that comparison. And I agree with you, boundless respect is due to Garrison Keillor. I mean, he really has brought back a way of American storytelling about its roots that I think has just been gone too long. He's absolutely masterful. But these were real people, and the stakes were real. And while it wasn't a life or death story that was being told, it was a story that really gets to the heart of whether we... really, whether small towns have an economic future. Do they? I mean, it seems to me that American towns are in terrible, terrible trouble. And what do you do when a town runs out of money? You don't tear down the buildings and crate them up and put them in some kind of storage set. You have to go on living. And I think that the decisions that the town fathers and the Chamber of Commerce people and the citizens of Hannibal were making that summer are being replicated all around the country. It's real, and I think that's what separated my book from a kind of a happy storytelling kind of approach.
You know, I have to say, in reading your book, I found myself thinking about Dolly Parton. Let me explain.
Please do.
I was watching her show last Sunday, and I thought, well, that is, for me, a just kind of really cynical...
Yeah.
version of what you've been talking about. And what I mean is that on her show, she's always paying homage to her small town roots and her working class background with these great, great big production numbers, you know. And she's even built a theme park to herself.
Dollywood,
yeah.
Yep.
And I just find it remarkable.
Yes. That's true. I mean, you can find it, Civil War battlefields, historic districts in Midwestern towns. What we have done, really, Terry, is we have leapt almost unconsciously into the television idiom of reducing and simplifying a concept or an idea and turned it into a logo. That is what I think goes on, these examples that we've been mentioning, and I think it was in danger of happening in Hannibal. And Mark Twain, yes, he was probably a kindly, avuncular man who told pleasant stories about boys painting fences, but he was also a dark and dangerous prophet of the 20th century in terms of religion and warfare and capitalism. He had disturbing things to say that ought still to be heard, and that is the Mark Twain that I think that we have been in danger of losing.
My guest is Ron Powers, and we're talking about his book, White Town Drowsing, which is about his return to Hannibal, Missouri. Ron Powers is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning media critic, and we're going to talk about his work as a journalist and media critic in just a few seconds. But first, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Ron Powers is my guest. Let's talk about your career with newspapers and television.
Mm-hmm.
When you started writing about television, were you assigned to it, or did you want that beat?
I wanted it. Well, I wanted a column. This was back in the last days of the front page era of Chicago newspaper life, back in the early and mid-70s, when the town still had four dailies and there was a newspaper culture and you could be a star if you had a byline, and there was still a lot of emphasis on style, individual writing. People like Roger Ebert and Bob Green and all these guys were cutting their teeth in newspaper journalism. And I was just blown in from St. Louis, where I'd been writing high school sports and county government meetings, and I thought, this is my chance. So the television column became available, and I said, I'd sure like to have that, please. And they said, okay. But the interesting thing about that era was that the four critics who were writing in Chicago were all, I think, all terrific. And we were just starting to change the whole focus and purpose of the television column. It had been, up until then, sort of an offshoot of the nightclub beat. There were nice pieces about tonight's programs and what Susie Starlet is doing and the primetime strategies. We were turning it into a consumer issue. These were the years of the tag end, really, of the counterculture. Action for Children's Television was getting going in Boston. Michael Arlen was covering the Vietnam War through the prism of television and comparing it to the actual sensibilities of what it was like in the field. And we realized that we were on to a branch of journalism that had as much power and as much influence as the op-ed page or the editorial columns, and we tried to write it like that.
Was that your interest, that consumer angle? Because I figure if you didn't own a TV, you probably weren't that interested in television programs.
Well, it was easy, you know, to do a little reading about some of the good writing that was done in television. You could very quickly get excited about it. And certainly there was a large constituency. I was astonished at the amount of, and the intensity of letters that I would get after a column came out. So you had the sense that it was an sort of an untouched nerve that we the four critics in Chicago who were writing, started touching, and it became a very gratifying and exciting thing to write about.
You left Chicago newspapers to work for CBS Television on CBS Sunday Morning. Did you start seeing TV differently once you started working in it?
Well, I really left newspapers to write a lot of famous novels and emerge from the Connecticut woods and get the National Book Award every year. That didn't happen, Terry. I don't know why, but it didn't. So I started freelancing in television. And sure, of course, your perspective changes. There's a lot of virtuosity that goes into being a good television performer that is almost impossible to understand when you're on the other side of the screen. I mean, to take one handy example, my colleague on Sunday Morning, Charles Kuralt, everybody knows him as avuncular and gentle and sensitive toward the rhythms of America. What they don't realize is that he's a frighteningly good user of that television camera and microphone. The way he can read from a teleprompter consistently a line a second so that the director in the booth can bring up natural sound from a soundtrack and know that Charles won't intrude on it with his voice. The way he signals a sort of change of thought or a change of mood in his delivery with an almost operatic, subtle shift of an octave, a half note. And that kind of awareness, which is almost impossible. It's like learning a backhand. Man was not meant to learn to hit a backhand. Man was not meant to learn to do television. Some people do it extraordinarily well.
I guess what I'm wondering is this, when you're reviewing television on television, is it possible to keep your journalistic distance?
I try. I do, and I try not very hard not to become an advocate. I try to distance myself from the corporation that is CBS, and I think I've been pretty successful about that. I mean, I don't think I could be totally objective about Sunday Morning because I identify with the program and I'm very proud of it and I make no pretenses about it. But as for the rest of the strategies and the practices of television news, what CBS is doing in prime time, or really even the ancient competition between television and the print world, I think I'm pretty objective about that because, for one thing, I work in both. And I'm sort of horrified, really, at what I think is one of the ongoing stories of the 1980s, the degree to which broadcasting has sort of colonized the world of print and created a new kind of magazine and newspaper imitator that has all of the characteristics, the brevity, the color, the obsession with data, the lack of context that makes it a kind of freeze-dried television. And as a person who likes the written word and appreciates good storytellers and good writers, I think this is a dangerous trend.
Are you talking about magazines that pay more attention to graphics than they do to the articles? Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Sure. People, the Gannett approach to newspapering, USA Today, they certainly try not to say, Gannett is not saying, we want to replace the New York Times, we want to be a supplement. But they've had shockwaves that have extended into the New York Times, I think. The creation of the living section, the whole shift from ideas to personalities, I think, has been generated by the onslaught of the broadcast idiom.
Well, with that said, I think I have to ask you the real tough question, Ron Powers. What are your favorite shows of this season?
There's a new season? Well, let's see. I like Slap Maxwell. I think that's a lot of fun. It's a terrific show. I love the writing in it. I like the wonderful character who is so pompous and vain and so deliciously out of it that he becomes almost endearing. I relish that show. I'm fascinated with, well, you know, I sort of like to dial around. I'm sort of like most consumers when I watch. I sit there with the console on my lap and the 36 buttons, and if I'm not stimulated every 6 or 7 seconds, I hit something else. So I'm probably a terrible example of somebody to ask. My 6-year-old is developing very bad habits.
Well, you mentioned you have a 6-year-old. I think you have 2 sons.
Right.
And now that there are children of television watching age in the house, do you feel differently about watching television? Do you try to limit their television watching? I always wonder how TV critics handle this.
Well, I've learned from them. I really have learned from them. I used to hear television critics who were parents say that, and I used to say, come on. But you do. You learn that they pick up the secondary messages of television, the sort of the social values and biases that commercials generate, for instance, when there's an old grandfatherly type who represents real orange juice and the smart young kids are the frozen orange juice. Well, my 6-year-old feels sorry for the grandfatherly type, and he's right. Also, in terms of limiting it, both my wife and I have made it a practice almost since birth to read aloud to the children. We rather than tell them, no, don't watch, we just have storybooks as a presence in the living room and in the kids' room at night. And that's kind of a charming way to go about it.
Do you enjoy bad television? Really bad.
Oh, I guess I do. I'm sort of interested in the new wave of television talk shows now that they finally found a way to bring the TV talk show into the 21st century, and that is to release the audience as a kind of an attack dog on the guest. And I'm sort of charting this and watching it, and there's a new kind of tabloid frenzy that's getting into news shows that aren't produced by the networks. We have tabloid news, gossip news, all kinds of, post-entertainment tonight kinds of approaches to journalism, and it's fun and a little bit horrifying to track.
Do you watch Entertainment Tonight?
Don't ask.
Why not?
I gave up an interview with them to come here, Terry.
Did you really?
No.
Then I'm not even flattered.
Sure, I watch.
I love the way they've made celebrity stuff into the news format. It's wonderful.
Yeah, exactly.
So, actually, we're out of time. Let me just ask you, how much TV do you have to watch for the job, and how much do you watch as a civilian?
Well, I find that I watch a lot for the job, but I spend a lot of time on the telephone. I try to get to know the people in the industry. I found that my reading time has increased as I try to take account of the real world so I can compare it to what's going out on the screen. But definitely watch more than I used to, and I sometimes feel strange when I go to a movie for recreation and find that I can't change channels if I'm not enjoying what I'm seeing.
Oh, boy.
I was just kidding about that.
I know what you mean, though. Ron Powers, thank you so much talking with us. I've been speaking with Ron Powers, who is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He has also written a book about his hometown of Hannibal, Missouri, and about his recent return there, and it's called White Town Drowsing, and it's just been published in paperback by Penguin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist Leslie Coburn. She's written a book on the Reagan administration's covert war in Nicaragua, the illegal shipment of arms, and the Contra drug connection. It's titled Out of Control, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with James Lachlan, the dean of small press publishers. In 1936, he founded New Directions Books as an outlet for experimental and unconventional writing. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward shows how Sam Cooke crossed over from gospel to soul. And book critic John Leonard reviews Peter Dickinson's latest mystery, Perfect Gallows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. A spokesman for Continental Airlines said today that all procedures had been followed to make certain ice was off the wings of Flight 1713 before it crashed Sunday night near Denver. 27 people died in that accident. One of the survivors has said he saw new ice forming on the wings just before takeoff. The plane had been de-iced about 20 minutes earlier. The flight crew's inexperience in flying DC-9s is also being considered in the crash's aftermath. The captain in command of the Continental flight had been a captain for less than 3 weeks, while the co-pilot, who was 26 years old, had been hired just 6 months earlier. The chief Soviet and American arms control negotiators have finished 3 days of special meetings in Geneva. Despite some last-minute hitches, both say an intermediate-range missile treaty will be ready in time for the December 7th summit meeting. More from Burton Bolag.
U.S. negotiator Max Kampelman and his Soviet counterpart Yuli Vorontsov have been holding unusually intensive negotiations in an effort to clear up the last differences between the two sides. Some last-minute hitches have come up. Today, in a Soviet television interview, Vorontsov accused the United States of raising artificial obstacles. He said this included a, quote, pretty strange U.S. proposal for eliminating the missiles, dismantling them but not destroying the parts, and last week's, quote, unnecessary U.S. demand to be able to inspect long-range missile factories since they could also produce intermediate-range missiles. But nonetheless, the Soviet official predicted the treaty would soon be finished, perhaps as early as next week. U.S. negotiator Max Kampelman said the same, insisting the treaty will be completed in time for the summit. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
Iraqi warplanes raided an Iranian nuclear power plant today, killing 11 people, that according to reports on Iranian radio. The plant, which has been bombed at least 5 times since 1983, has been under construction for several years. French President François Mitterrand faces new allegations that his government carried out illegal arms sales to Iran. The charges surfaced just hours after he denied responsibility in the affair. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
A right-wing newspaper in Lyon today said that between 1982 and 86, when President Mitterrand's socialist government was in power, French Air Force planes carried illegal arms shipments to Iran. The paper cited an unnamed military officer and published what it said were freight receipts of the shipments. The French arms company cited in the report denied responsibility. The allegation is the most serious so far in the arms scandal that emerged earlier this month. According to an army report, the former socialist government allowed the sales of 500,000 artillery shells to Iran. Yesterday, Mitterrand said he had been informed of possible violations against the arms embargo, but said poor controls were to blame for not pinning down the traffic. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Congressional and administration budget negotiators say there's a good chance they'll reach an agreement by Friday on a plan to cut the federal deficit. If they don't, automatic cuts of $23 billion will go into effect. While optimistic about the possibility of reaching agreement by Friday, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the world won't come to an end if final details aren't worked out by then. The mayor of Charleston, West Virginia, pleaded guilty today to 6 misdemeanor counts of cocaine possession as part of an agreement requiring him to resign from office by November 24th. Mayor Mike Rourke could be sentenced to 6 years in prison and fined $30,000. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 27 points to 1922.25. Declines led advances 4-1 on volume of 148 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of the early years of singer Sam Cooke's career, before records like You Send Me and Wonderful World. Ed goes back to Cooke's gospel roots, which continued to influence Cooke from his first hit to his last.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
I don't know how many times I've picked up a soul singer's biography and read that their career started in church. The black church has always been where the soul and soul singing comes from, yet it's not always easy to show that fact clearly. But in the case of Sam Cooke, the man who very nearly invented soul music, we can hear it happen. The story starts with the Soul Stirrers.
Why should I feel discouraged? Why should the shadows fall? Why should my heart feel lonely, dark and long for my heavenly home? For Jesus is my portion, a constant friend is He. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know He.
Soul Stirrers were one of America's top gospel groups, founded in the 30s around the incomparable singer R.H. Harris, whom we heard singing His Eyes on the Sparrow. But in 1950, Harris decided to retire, and the Soul Stirrers, who were still headliners, searched for a replacement. They found him in Sam Cooke, a minister's son from Chicago, who was only 16 years old but was already a veteran of the gospel scene after singing for a couple of years with another top group, the Highway QCs. He had the looks, he had the experience, and as they found out the first time they went into the studio with him, he had the voice.
Oh, you know the bear will be gentle. You know the wolves gonna be so tame. Mighty lion, he will lie down with a lamb.
Don't discount the value of looks, either. Gospel music is still show business, and yet it's a kind the young tend not to go see. Suddenly, the old men in the Soul Stirrers found they were getting young girls in the front rows, and that the frenzy was wilder than usual.
Sometimes, I like to be in the company, and then again, I like to steal off all alone. A song is the only thing, Father, that will console me, Lord. Trouble's about to come. I can fall down on my knees and call God day and night, and I know God he'll make my burdens all right. If I tell him, Lord, I've got a desire.
Yeah.
Even on this fairly primitive live recording of Nearer to Thee, made in Los Angeles in the mid-50s, you can get an inkling of the excitement Sam Cooke generated, a palpably sexual reaction that's similar to, but different from, the normal gospel fan's reaction. And those of you who are familiar with Sam's later work will recognize where he got Bring It On Home to Me. By 1956, Sam Cooke was 21 years old and feeling the urge to move on. He secretly recorded a pop song, Lovable, and released it under the name Dale Cooke. The reaction was strong enough that he handed the Soul Stirrers his resignation and never looked back. The gospel world was scandalized, and a rumor circulated that Sam Cooke had sold his soul to the devil. If he had, the devil had gotten himself a bargain. Sam Cooke had more soul than most people. Although he tried to reconcile with the gospel world and get it to accept what he'd done, he was an outcast among them and remained that way until the night in 1961 when he was shot to death in a still unexplained incident in a motel. Today, Sam Cooke's pop recordings still stand as milestones, but anybody who loves his singing really owes it to themselves to look into the place where it started, with the Soul Stirrers.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Oh, there was a woman in the Bible days. She had been sick, sick so very long. But she heard my Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, "What are you trying to do?" She said, "If I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole."
You're listening to Fresh Air. Modern literature wouldn't be what it is today if it weren't for James Lachlan and his publishing company, New Directions Books. He published now famous poets like Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams when no one else would take a chance on them. Lachlan founded New Directions in 1936 to publish experimental and unconventional writing. Books that he believed in, he kept in print even when they lost money. Some of the other now famous writers he's published include Samuel Beckett, Jean-Paul Sartre, Delmore Schwartz, and Dylan Thomas. Lachlan has just completed an anthology of his essays on Ezra Pound. In 1934, Lachlan went to Europe to study with Pound at what was known as the Ezuversity.
I was there, half a year, and at one point came time for me to go back to the States. My parents were howling at me, and the subject came up of what I would do. And he said, "It's useless for you to try to be a poet because you simply are not any good. And it is useless for you to try to write fiction because Stendhal and Flaubert and Joyce and James and the rest of them have done everything that can possibly be done with fiction. So you had better try to do something useful." So he thought up the idea that he would make a publisher out of me, though I was, you know, I was 20 years old and I knew nothing whatever about publishing. But he said, "Well, just find a printer, that's all you need, find a printer, and learn to print the pages right side up, and then you'll be a publisher. And I will give you some of my books to print, and I'll arrange with my friends, my writer friends, to give you books to print."
You started New Directions with family money. Your,
yes.
Your family was partners in Jones and Lachlan Steel Company in Pittsburgh. Were you expected to go into the family business?
Well, my parents were very decent about that. They would have been, I think, happy if I had. And I know my father used to take me down to the mill now and then to try to inculcate a love of ironmongering in me. But it didn't take at all because I found the whole atmosphere utterly terrifying, and I wanted, if I possibly could, to get out of that connection. And he was, both my parents, my father and my mother, were very decent about it, and they didn't try to, you know, to buffalo me. And they kept giving me my allowance, which was what I ran New Directions on for, many years. I ran it on my allowance.
What is the mission that you've given yourself in terms of what kinds of writing you want to publish?
Well, I've been very Catholic. By that, I don't mean Roman Church. I mean, various and diversified. And I've published all sorts of different kinds of things, and the test always was whether how much I liked it. I mean, I've been totally selfish about the publishing that I did at New Directions, and was able to be selfish simply because I had this stipend from my family. So that we've done a lot of translations, a lot of poetry, a lot of anthologies, just about anything that appealed to me or was recommended to me by one of our writers or one of my friends that I thought was first rate and was important. And I was particularly interested at first in doing books which were not being published by any of the big commercial publishers.
In the 10th anniversary issue of the New Dimensions anthology, you criticized the people who you called the most fragrantly commercial publishers.
Yes. I used to write the most horrible introduction.
Well, let me quote something you said. You called the most flagrantly commercial publishers sinners who you hoped would burn in hell for a considerable time. And you wrote, I have been too close to the suffering of 20 to 30 first-rate talents to whom our famous American way of life has offered the choice of writing trash or living worse than a dog on the streets, ever to curb my resentment against the people responsible for their predicament. What were some of the problems that you witnessed writers having?
I was a terribly arrogant young man, and my arrogance was only equaled by my ignorance. I mean, here I was at that time, I was, in my 20s, and I was spouting around about world literature, and at that time I really hadn't read it very well. But yes, I would go after people, and I once wrote that Bennett Cerf, he was a pretty good guy, that he was a traitor to our culture because he had let Stendhal's Charter House of Parma translation go out of print. And that was the kind of utterance that I was putting out all the time. I was a holier than thou and righteous and superior. And I think it had a certain publicity value for getting people curious to read some of the books that we published. But there were many cases like that. I could run through and tell you of people who were so very good who simply did not have publishers.
I'd like to get back to something that you said a little earlier. You had explained that you started New Directions after Ezra Pound suggested that you give up poetry and give up writing and start publishing. Now, you must have been very depressed by that. It's pretty crushing to hear.
Yeah, it was a blow when, I remember the day very well. I had brought these poems to him, and he was having lunch, and he went through them with his stub pencil, and he said, you don't need that word, and that isn't what you mean to say. And then finally he just got disgusted and tore the whole little sheaf of poetry up. So it was a long time before I felt very confident as a poet. But the person who cheered me up about poetry was William Carlos Williams, his friend, who became a great friend of mine. And I'd shown Bill Williams a few of the things I'd written, and he was the most sympathetic person for young writers. He was the one who brought Allen Ginsberg along and so many others.
Is there a short verse or poem that you've written that you know well enough to be able to read for us?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a poem I wrote, I think, a long time ago. This must have been written. Well, this would have been from the period when Williams was encouraging me. But he certainly didn't encourage me to pick out a flossy, arty title like the one the poem has, which is The Glacier and Love's Ignorant Tongue. Now, Glacier is there because I was in my youth and still am a ski bug and a mountaineering bug, and I was always skiing on glaciers and having romantic thoughts. The sloth of the glacier surpasseth understanding. Like I could fly, he said, just like I could fly in the air like an angel, like a bird, fly all over hell and see everything, everywhere, all at once. The life of the glacier, its whole life, turning slow flanks of snow from generation to generation. Well, now it goes on. My God, it goes on six more stanzas, and I think we've had enough of that.
When you started writing poems again, did Pound ever give you any encouragement? You know, because initially he had discouraged you, but when you picked it up again and started writing again, did he ever like the poems?
Well, he never told me that he did. I sent him a few, of course, but I was very cheered to hear one day I ran into Robert Creeley, the great poet, and he said, you know, I was visiting Ezra in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and he read me a poem of yours and said, he said, that's not too bad for jazz. That's what he called me. Not too bad for jazz, is it? So I was very cheered to hear that. It was the first kind word about my poetry that I'd ever had from him.
How active are you now in the day-to-day operations of New Directions?
I've gotten awfully tired of New York City's life, so that I try to work as much as possible up at home. And that means that they have a wonderful staff here in New York, just a small staff, just 7 people, because our distribution is done by Norton. But they're wonderful people, and they call me up if they have a problem, and then they send manuscripts up for me to read, and then they send all the letters up to me in the country. I live 100 miles from New York, that they think I should answer personally, letters to the author or somebody else. And so that I'm, without actually being tied down in the office, I'm right in touch with everything pretty much all the time.
I have read that you took out a life insurance policy with New Directions as the benefactor. Is that right?
Yes, that exists, and the point of that is that the wheels shouldn't stop grinding when I kick off. In other words, there will be funds available to the staff to keep things going, to meet commitments, to even take on further additional books, so that the authors of New Directions are not put out to dry without a publisher.
James Lachlan's New Directions Books has just published its 51st annual anthology. Lachlan's new book on Ezra Pound, Pound as Was, is published by Grey Wolf Press. Lachlan spoke to us from an office in Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, there's a minority report on the Iran-Contra investigation. It's being released along with the regular report. Republicans on the committee are dissenting from the majority. They call the majority report a partisan attack on the president. Also, we have a report on effects of the stock market crash beginning to make themselves known throughout the economy, filtering through 4 weeks after the crash, a report on India population control techniques, and also inside a Soviet visa office.
Was that Robert Siegel who was inside the office?
Yes, Robert did this story while he was in Moscow. He visited a Soviet visa office, a report on reforms in the Soviet Union and how that is affecting visas.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peter Dickinson is a British author who was born in Zambia and educated at Eton and Oxford. He has written 16 children's books and an equal number of novels, including several mysteries. His latest is called Perfect Gallows. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
Some of us meet like druids late at night to read Peter Dickinson's murder mysteries, and some of us are worried. A Dickinson murder happens typically in some weird anthropological elsewhere, in Africa or Arabia or New Zealand, in caves or monasteries where no god dare set foot, and we're so busy enjoying his art that we don't pick up on a certain creepy obsessiveness. But lately this Dickinson, who has always hated rationalism and modern science, seems also to hate artfulness itself. His recent novel Hindsight, for example, was all about a novelist finding out that his own life was a novel with the wrong last chapter. Perfect Gallows is a novel about a play in which an actor can't change the lines in his own last act. Art, Dickinson has decided, is a lie, a counterfeit. This makes him tired and angry. He stopped being playful and is merely obsessive. Old fans will be dismayed. New readers should begin instead with The Green Gene or The Poison Oracle. Perfect Gallows alternates between wartime England in 1944 and Thatcher's London in 1986. In 1944, Andrew Ragg, age 18, is summoned to Mimms, the manor house of his distant cousin, Sir Arnold. Sir Arnold, attended by two unlovely daughters and a Zulu manservant, is a brandy-bloated old toad who made millions in diamonds from various crimes against black South Africans. He requires a male heir. Arrogant Andrew would rather make his own money as an actor, but lingers anyway at Mimms to practice his persuasions on a luckless local lass, to play Prospero in a local production of The Tempest, and to read aloud to the Zulu manservant, who will also play the role of Caliban, from a book about the bestialities of the Black King Shaka. An impostor will inherit Mimms, the Zulu will be found hanged in a nearby pigeon loft, and feckless Andrew will run off to other stages with, quote, the egotism of his art. In 1986, Andrew is now Adrian, a famous actor with a secret other self. After many almost vintage Dickinson passages on the English upper-class horror show and sex as a performance art, there's no reason why Perfect Gallows couldn't be a good novel, or at least a good mystery. It is neither. We've figured out who did what to whom and why long before the last 12 rushed and all-explaining pages. Dickinson forgets to tell us whatever he meant to symbolize by the Tempest and his Zulus to begin with. As if he were in a hurry to end a distasteful business, he leaves us with a brutal, almost slapdash cartoon of human relationships that's all domination and submission, all power and no love, like the worst fiction of Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal. Maybe we're being told that love, like art, is just another lie, a counterfeit. What a big talent to waste on such a little message.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Perfect Gallows by Peter Dickinson. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with novelist Jan Novák, a Czechoslovakian emigre who's lived in Chicago for 17 years. His new comic novel is based on his own observations on the job as a mid-level bureaucrat at the phone company. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review an album of Elizabethan lute music performed by Paul Odette. And Jan-Harald Brunvand will explore the urban legends that have sprung up around computer glitches, the so-called mystery glitches. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.